Last month, Mayor Sam Sullivan and Councillor Kim Capri announced an initiative to combat public disorder in Vancouver. According to the Mayor's website, manifestations of public disorder include, among other things, aggressive panhandling, jaywalking, graffiti, and sleeping in public parks. The elements of the strategy are similar to a crime control strategy called Broken Windows that's been applied in many United States cities, which suggests that disorder and petty offences lead to more serious crime. Stephen Herbert is a geographer at the University of Washington, and he's joined me on the phone from Seattle to give us some background on this theory. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning to you.
So now, where does this idea of the broken windows come from?
The idea was first introduced into public conversation in 1982 when two American criminologists, James Q. Wilson and George Kelling, wrote an article for an American news magazine called The Atlantic Monthly. And in it, they made precisely the argument you just summarized, which is to suggest that evidence of disorder in an urban neighborhood, such as broken windows, can lead residents of that neighborhood to withdraw from public life, that they are scared of evidence of this disorder, and so they kind of remove themselves from the social life of the neighborhood. And as a consequence of that, they are less active agents of informal social control. And then as a consequence of that, then people who are interested in more serious crimes, such as burglary or robbery, interpret that neighborhood as a place where they can pursue their crimes without fear of sanction. And so the argument is that evidence of disorder today will lead neighborhood residents to withdraw, and that will then make it more likely that more serious crime will emerge in the future.
That's quite a huge leap there. What kind of assumptions does broken windows make about the relationship between crime and the environment then?
Again, the argument is that if people travel through a neighborhood and they see evidence of disorder, which can be evidenced in a number of different ways, according to Kelling and Wilson, such as panhandlers, public inebriates, prostitutes, that sort of kind of low-level criminal offender, or what some people would consider a disorderly element. The assumption is that once those people start to emerge and they are inadequately policed, then people become fearful. And once they're fearful, then they pull away from the social life of the neighborhood, and therefore they sort of leave things open for more serious criminals to invade the area and engage in more serious criminality. So the assumption is that disorder today leads to a decline of informal social control, and once that decline of informal social control is evident, then more serious criminals will invade.
And so then what are the assumptions then following on with that, that it's making about human behavior? Are there assumptions implied in that theory?
Oh, yeah, there are lots of assumptions. I mean, there's assumption that people read the landscape in particular ways, that people are predisposed to be afraid of certain types of other people, such as panhandlers or public inebriates, and also that criminals are rational actors in the sense that they travel through city space and they look for signs of disorder such that they feel more emboldened to engage in crime in such places as opposed to other places.
So then how do proponents of broken windows account for factors like poverty or lack of support for people with mental illness or addiction issues?
They tend not to focus on that so much. And people like James Wilson and George Kelling view that sort of thinking as what they call root causes criminological theory. In other words, they argue that thinking about poverty or race relations or the housing market, that those sorts of factors are sort of deeply structural, and they they're difficult to address. On the other hand, what you can do, though, however, if those sorts of conditions are difficult to remedy, in the meantime, what you can do in a particular location is try to create conditions within that more micro location where you can attempt to discourage criminality from emerging. So, another popular approach these days is what's called situational crime prevention. It's a similar sort of set of ideas in which you focus upon the particular conditions in a certain place, whether there's fences, whether there's lighting, whether people are able to enter and exit easily, where you can concentrate on the more small-scale realities in a given place and seek to address them, sort of leaving the root causes off to one side because you can't necessarily do that much about them.
Wow, that's extraordinary. So essentially ignoring the bigger issues, underlying issues, just because they're more difficult to actually grapple with.
Right, right.
Now, the broken windows became prominent when it was associated with New York Mayor's Rudolph Giuliani's campaign to clean up areas like Times Square.
Correct.
What effects did the application of broken windows have in New York?
Well, that's a question of some considerable academic debate. And essentially what happened in New York is the broken windows ideology was recast, or sort of more muscularly recast, as zero tolerance policing. So the idea in New York was that all of these instances of disorderly behavior, and in New York the big iconic figure was the squeegee man, the man who approached cars stopped in traffic and cleaned their windshields and then demanded payment. And so what they did in New York is they declared a zero tolerance policy for all such street level behaviors and arrested people en masse for any of these relatively minor criminal offenses. And what happened in New York City at the same time that was going on was a reduction in crime. And so the big debate in academic circles has revolved around the question of whether or not those zero tolerance tactics were in fact the cause for the reduction in that crime. And certainly Mayor Giuliani would and very, very publicly proclaimed that there was a direct relation, but subjected to more serious scrutiny, that claim doesn't appear to hold up.
What happened to the populations that were previously involved in those criminal behaviors?
Well, they've been sort of displaced to other parts of New York. And the other thing that's happened in places like Times Square is a tremendous amount of property reinvestment and redevelopment occurred, such that once those populations were arrested away, lots of redevelopment came in behind it.
Just based from what I've been hearing you saying, do you think that there's any truth to the analysis that the theory of this broken windows
right.
Approach, or is it incidental, the successes that they're having?
Well, the original argument from Kelling and Coles was largely speculative. They didn't have much evidence for the assertion, but the line of thinking became very popular, I think, because it was a relatively easy way of thinking about it. People were easily able to understand it, and I think it made a certain amount of intuitive sense to people. Since 1982, however, on four different occasions, social scientists have sought to determine whether, in fact, disorder today leads to crime tomorrow, and has sort of subjected that theory to more rigorous empirical testing. And in no case has that connection been found to be empirically true.
Are there other theories of crime control and environment that are posed as alternatives to this currently?
Well, that's a good question. I think you still have the sort of debate within academic circles that we sort of rehearsed a few moments ago. In other words, sort of more macro kinds of approaches that focus on structural disadvantage, poverty, the operations of the housing market, race relations, which are particularly potent here in the United States, those more macro-oriented approaches versus these more micro-oriented approaches that focus on the particular conditions in particular places, and suggest that even if there's significant poverty in a country, that you might still be able to discourage people from engaging in criminality to such a great extent that they will desist from doing so. And I think so many of these more micro-oriented approaches, like broken windows and situational crime prevention, are being tested and studied to determine whether, in fact, they work. And it appears as if, in some cases, they do work. The problems are, however, that oftentimes they require a very intensive level of police resources that are difficult to sustain over time. And there's also the problem of displacing. So, in other words, if you make it difficult for a prostitute or a drug dealer to work in place X, there appears to be evidence that in many cases they'd simply relocate to place Y. And so there is some, in some circles, support for these more micro-oriented approaches, but yet it appears as if they are both difficult to sustain over time, and that they simply, in many cases, simply displace people to another location.
Now, Vancouver's often described as a prototype of a new post-industrial city. What's the relationship between the economies of modern cities and the push for this more orderly urban environment?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think many of us see a relationship between the emergence of these types of criminological theories and the transformation of the contemporary city. As cities have become less and less reliant on their industrial base for their economic health, they have necessarily become more interested in the consumption sphere, the sphere of consumption, thinking about shoppers and tourists, and therefore they're perceiving a stronger need to have a more aesthetically pleasing landscape that will lure tourists and shoppers, particularly into downtown areas. And so many of us argue that the emergence of these criminological theories that urge police and others to try to sweep undesirable people out, that the rise of those criminological theories is very much connected to the need for cities to be more aesthetically pleasing in order to bolster the sphere of consumption.
Wow, that's fascinating stuff. Well, thanks very much for taking the time to talk with me this morning. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Stephen Herbert. He's an associate professor in the geography department at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he recently co-authored an article called Conceptions of Space and Crime in the Neoliberal City, and it's published in the journal Antipode.